By the opening days of 1915, Europe had already learned that the war it had imagined in the summer of 1914 was not the war it was actually fighting. The confident predictions of a short campaign, the patriotic parades, the railway timetables, the speeches about honor and swift victory, all now seemed to belong to another world. Only a few months had passed since the assassination at Sarajevo and the declarations of war that followed, yet those months had been enough to shatter the old assumptions of generals, politicians, and ordinary citizens alike. The great armies of Europe had marched with breathtaking speed, collided with terrifying violence, and then, almost unbelievably, stopped. The phrase, a war without movement, might seem strange at first. There was movement everywhere in 1915, shells moved through the air, trains moved men and ammunition toward the front, stretcher-bearers moved the wounded through mud and darkness, refugees moved away from ruined towns, and governments moved entire economies into the service of war. But on the Western Front, where so much of the world's attention settled, the armies themselves barely moved at all. What had begun as a war of advance and maneuver had hardened into a war of position. Soldiers did not so much march toward victory as dig themselves into the earth and wait for the next order to attack a line that often looked almost identical to the line attacked the month before. The transition had not happened overnight, but by 1915 it was impossible to ignore. In the west, German forces held much of Belgium and northeastern France. The Allies, mainly the French Army and the British Expeditionary Force, faced them across a long, jagged scar of trenches stretching from the North Sea to the Swiss frontier. This was not a single neat line but a vast defensive system, constantly expanded, repaired, flooded, shelled, and rebuilt. Between the opposing trenches lay no man's land, a zone that could be narrow enough for soldiers to hear the enemy speaking or wide enough to disappear into fog, shell holes, wire, and corpses. Beyond the front line were support trenches, reserve trenches, artillery positions, supply roads, communication lines, dressing stations, depots, and villages transformed into military machinery. The war had become rooted in geography, but also in routine. The tragedy of 1915 was that Europe's leaders had not yet accepted the full meaning of this new reality. They understood that the front had stabilized, but many still believed that the deadlock could be broken by courage, pressure, artillery, or one more carefully planned offensive. They had not yet developed the weapons, tactics, communications, and combined methods necessary to restore genuine mobility. Nor could they easily abandon the offensive spirit that had dominated pre-war military thinking. To many commanders, remaining passive seemed morally and strategically dangerous. An army that did not attack might lose initiative. A government that did not pursue victory might lose public confidence. A coalition that did not pressure its enemy might collapse under the burden of waiting. So, despite the evidence of 1914, the armies of 1915 continued to attack. This made the year one of expansion and stalemate at the same time. The war widened geographically, drawing in new fronts, new peoples, and new ambitions. Yet, on the most symbolically important front in Western Europe, it remained trapped in mud, wire, and firepower. That contradiction shaped the character of the year. The conflict became larger without becoming more decisive. It became more industrial without becoming more controllable. It became more global without becoming more flexible. Soldiers and civilians alike began to understand that the war was not merely a military crisis but a historical rupture, something capable of consuming time, bodies, economies, and faith. To understand why 1915 became a year of immobility, one must look back to the closing months of 1914. Germany's initial campaign in the West had been built around speed,